The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Consumption Smoothing Edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as usual, by Anna Shemansky and Jordan Weissman.
Hello.
Hello.
And Rachel Schneider.
Hello.
Hello. Rachel is a published author. I have your book sitting in front of me. What is it called and what is it about?
It is called The Financial Diaries, How Americans' Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And it's really the stories that arise out of research that I did with a professor at NYU named Jonathan Wardock. And we talked to 235 families and gathered information about their financial lives over the course of a full year.
This is every single penny that people spend. It's an amazingly detailed and granular data set. And we will dive into it very shortly. We are also going to be talking about Affirm, which is Max Levchin's not so new anymore company, where he's doing some interesting things with financing purchases. We are going to be talking about some of the information which is trickling out, at least about 30 different cities, and how much they're bribing Amazon, basically, to get Amazon to place its second HQ in them. We are also, if you're a Slate Plus listener, going to answer all of Jordan Weissman's questions about cross-currency basis swaps.
It's going to be a guide for the perplexed. Namely, I am the perplexed, and Anna's going to guide me.
This is going to be like a semi-regular segment on Slate Plus where Jordan says, I read something in the Wall Street Journal and I don't understand it. Please, Anna, explain it.
It's my own little Mishnah Torah. It's going to be great.
But yeah, let's start with the financial diaries because Rachel's here. You didn't concentrate on like the poorest Americans. You kind of took a pretty broad swathe. And it turns out that even if you're solidly in the middle class, and even if you have a full-time job, you can still wind up with unintuitively enormous fluctuations in monthly income and cash flow.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, we were working with people. One of the criterion was every family had somebody who had a job, right? So this wasn't a study about what is happening with people who don't have jobs. It was a study about working people and trying to understand what's happening in their lives. Now, they weren't upper income people, right? The band we were working with was, you know, from the poverty line up till about two times the poverty line, which is around the area median. So it's, you know, people.
So what's that in dollars for a household of four, say?
Now I'm jumping ahead to the numbers section, but the median household income in the U.S. is $59,000 for a family of four. So
And what's twice the poverty line?
It's roughly around there. Like, it depends where you're talking about.
The poverty line is generally about half median.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So not by any means rich, but certainly not. I mean, given the millions of Americans who are below the poverty line, we're not talking about them.
Exactly.
And obviously, a lot of these Americans have to pay the rent and other major expenses and medical expenses and stuff. But it's not just that unexpected large expenses can land in your lap at any time. It's also that your income, even with a full-time job, or especially if you don't have a full-time job, can just have huge variance, and that's not easy to cope with.
No, and that was really the most salient, the most sort of critical finding here, right? So we tracked people's monthly incomes, and in 5 out of 12 months in the year, on average, families had huge spikes and dips in their earnings, over, you know, at least 25% more, 25% less than the average. So everything you think about, like how somebody would budget, goes out the window. Right. When you think about budgeting, you tell somebody to figure out their monthly earnings, subtract their monthly expenses, only spend what's left. Right. But in 5 months of the year, that would have been nonsensical for the families we were talking about.
And is that something which it's even possible to budget for?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the math, like when you start then thinking about what we know from behavioral economics and the extent to which people are good at making decisions and good at estimating the future and assessing variability, then I think no, right?
Because I think if someone hasn't read your book, their response might be, well, if you know that you're going to have this variance in your income, why don't you spend less in the months when you make less? And why is that not the case?
And people do that, right? So we definitely saw spending go up and down with income. And we saw really creative strategies for how to manage it. So in the book, we tell the story of a woman named Becky. And what she does is when her husband has spikes in his earnings because his job is commission-based. So he works full-time, but the amount he makes still has wide swings. And so in the months that he earns more, she stocks the freezer, right? She is like a pantry full of toothpaste. She says, I'll never need to buy toothpaste again. We're good, right? what she says is, it's just really hard to save in cash. And I can't go to the movies and pay with a pork chop. So, right? So to me, it's really this human, like understanding what it means to be human. Like, yes, absolutely. Save, budget, borrow. But really, like, we don't really do that.
And you have this kind of great concept you talk about at the beginning of the book called the great job shift. And it was sort of something that when I read it, it was like, oh, this should have been obvious to me. But and I'll explain why in a second. But basically, it's the idea that used to be when you had a full-time job, you also had a regular income. Like you had a factory job, your income was, you know, you had your hours and it was consistent. And as we've moved away from that part of the economy and we have more people just working for tips in the service industry on sales commissions, that we've had this spike in volatility. Now our financial lives are less ordered, less predictable, like you say. And we've been seeing, I mean, you see stories about this constantly. You see stories about Starbucks employees with these weird schedules where they, at McDonald's workers who, you know, they get called in for these shifts and then suddenly told to go leave. And there are so many, or, you know, Walmart pioneered this. There's so many signs of this all around us that we should have kind of realized, yeah, this is what middle class life is, but we still hold on to this idea that once you have a job, that middle class, you should have a sort of consistent middle class life. And you're saying, no, it doesn't appear to be the case at all. So I guess what I'm kind of wondering is just how much of this has just been, how much of this can we kind of just blame on like technology? How much of it is just about the fact that companies have gotten too good at programming their workforces for like down to the second savings?
I think that is a huge source of it. So I went to business school, right? We can debate whether or not that was a good use of money offline. But when I went, the big thing that was being touted as amazing, good, wonderful, was just-in-time manufacturing, right?
Yeah.
This was huge trend in how companies thought about their productivity and their competitiveness. What you don't think about when you hear just-in-time manufacturing is that means just-in-time labor costs.
Yeah.
That's what that means. That means I'm going to send people home when I need to make fewer cars. And so what's happened really is, you know, a shift in the risk in demand for services from the institution that was designed to be able to weather that risk, right? That's what a corporation is designed to do. And shifting that risk down to individuals so that
So this is the big question which I have. And this is like the implication of what Jordan was saying. But, you know, I want to really nail it. You did a survey of families now. Did anyone do that survey 20 or 30 years ago so we know whether anything has changed?
No. I mean, this was really like difficult kind of research to do. And we were building off of similar research that was done in the developing world. And before that had been done, people weren't really trying to gather this deep of cash flow information. But what we do have is really good annual studies. And there are really solid analyses of how income volatility from year to year has risen dramatically. So in the last 40 years, income volatility year over year has risen by 30%.
So that actually goes against the simultaneous trend, which is a decline in social mobility, right? There's this lots of talk about how it's harder to move from one social class to another. How is that consistent with a spike in income, an annualized or annual income volatility?
Well, that assumes that somebody has multiple spikes multiple years in a row, right? But really what's happening is if one family has a spike this year, another family has a dip this year. And it's like the volatility is what's changing, not the likelihood that you'll repeatedly
right.
move up and up and up, right?
Yeah. There was another kind of small line you had in, that I thought was really interesting, where you pointed out also that corporations profits are starting to show more of this sort of spiking. And it just made me think about how, like, with Seasons, right? And it's not, their profits aren't as smooth as they used to be. And it just made me think that we're kind of becoming this weird seasonal economy almost. The entire, like, corporations' profits are moving up and down more than they people's individual incomes. And that creates a feedback loop. And it's kind of a scary thing. It just makes you think of the entire economy as this very erratic, just system.
Well, this was something I actually found kind of interesting to think of how things are changing. Because we have a tendency, I think, to think of like the kind of post-war boom to maybe 70s, 80s is like the normal, because that's what we always reference. But what I'm actually wondering, because when you hear about this seasonality, it sounds very similar to if you think of like economic history, like pre a lot of labor laws, where everything was entirely seasonal. So I'm kind of wondering if maybe the period we think as normal was actually the aberration.
Yeah, I think that's really right. I mean, that's my personal instinct. I'm not an economic historian, but yeah, we hold out the post-World War II decades as the benchmark. But they may have been an aberration in terms of economic security. That said, like, don't we want that to be the norm? And so what do we do to get closer to that being the norm?
Yeah, and then I think that raises then the next question, which I think you do also address in your book, about what are some of the products or some of the laws that could be passed to help this situation?
Yeah, so much. So, I mean, you asked about, shouldn't people just save and borrow? Couldn't they do a better job at that? And I do think that the innovation that you see in fintech is promising here. I think we're going to get to a place where you can use data to give people personalized advice, help them make better choices. I think we're at the start of an innovation wave around that. But for that to be successful, you have to maintain the CFPB, and you have to maintain, you have to think about consumer protections as well, because some of that data is not going to be used for the good of the consumer. Some of those predictive analytics are not going to be designed to help you make the best possible choices.
Right. Very often.
Yeah.
I have a question about incomes. We are seeing in the labor force data, finally, incomes rising, which is good, but let's assume, I think, a reasonable assumption after reading your book, which is that a lot, if not all of that rise in income is a rise in what you might call precarious or volatile income rather than a rise in steady income. And I guess my question is, having studied these individuals and talked to them, what's like the exchange rate? Like how much money would I need to make on a volatile basis to make up for like $50,000 a year of like guaranteed steady income?
Yeah, I love that way of thinking about it. I'm sure that value that varies based on risk aversion, right? I mean, so we had this family I was talking about, Becky and Jeremy, where Becky stockpiles in the freezer. Ultimately, Jeremy took a lower paying job in order to have stability.
And how much of a pay cut was that?
Oh, God, I don't know. It's a good question. But I think, and when I've told this story, right, because I've been like talking about them a lot, some people in the audience always think, well, that's just stupid. Like, why did he do that? Right?
Well, it's always because you can guarantee that you're going to be able to make rent. I mean,
right? Yeah.
But this is the other thing, right? It also is regressive in that if you're rich, if you have a nice little savings account with 3 months worth of spending in it, then you can totally afford to take a volatile income and it costs you nothing, and you get to get that boost in income if there is like a premium to volatility. If you're poor, you can't afford to do that.
Yeah, and worst comes worst, I mean, and worse than that, the poorer you are, the smaller change it takes in your income for it to be really volatile. The percentage, a small change can be a big percentage of your your paycheck.
Exactly.
And so you're more at risk for it, especially, you know, if you're like a car dealer who relies on tips, like one of the people you mentioned in your book.
Right. And also the your stuff is likely to be more likely to cause you trouble too, right? Like your car is likely to have more need for repair. And it's likely that you're in a community where other people are in the same position. So not only is this easier to weather if you have a cushion, it's easier to weather if you know somebody who has a cushion.
And I think this also speaks to how when you have more money, again, you can also, you have easier access to low-cost credit. You probably have, as you said, family members. Whereas the reality is the poorer you are, the higher your credit is going to cost, the less cushion you have, not just on your own money, but access to.
Agreed. And, you know, we also should think about this in the context of what kinds of jobs people have access to and what kind of power they have in the workforce. So, you know, great, Jeremy was able to get a different job. But that's not always the case, right? If you rely on tips as a waitress, like, it's pretty hard to get yourself a secure wage.
Yeah, there aren't very many like full-time non-tipped waitressing jobs out there.
No, exactly. So how do you trade your skill set for something that is going to be steady? And what negotiating power do you have to tell your boss, I need a minimum, a number of hours every week, which is something workers are arguing for across the country. But so far, it's not, you know, it's not an easy argument for them to win right now.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Brilliant. Okay, so that is the perfect segue to, you were mentioning fintech, and probably the single biggest thing that financial innovation that people use for consumption smoothing is the credit card. And if you do wind up with an unexpected expense, then what you do is you put that expense on your credit card, and then you can pay off the credit card over however many months or years, and you have managed to sort of amortize that expense in a way that you could afford to pay it. And not everyone has credit cards. And so along has come Max Levchin, who has...
To save us all.
To save us all. I mean, I'm going to come out and say that I like Max. I think he's...
We should probably say who Max is. One of, background.
Oh, he is the... Max is, let's say, the least weird of the PayPal mafia.
How big is the PayPal mafia? Obviously, you know, you got Thiel and Musk, but then beyond that...
And then, like, Reid Hoffman.
Okay, he
and,
is...
like, you know, there's a bunch of kind of, like, sort of spectrum-y people. And, But in any case, like, yeah, so Max was a co-founder of PayPal.
Yeah.
PayPal was obviously designed to solve payments questions, primarily, and just moving money around questions. And in a little way, his new shop, Affirm, is similar in that it's trying to replace credit cards, I think is a fair thing to say, but with two big differences between what Affirm does and how credit cards work. The first big difference is that he is using a bunch of underwriting techniques which allows him to extend credit to people who don't have credit cards or couldn't qualify for credit cards. And the second is that everything is done on a purchase-by-purchase basis. So you really know how much you're spending each month or each paycheck to pay off, you know, the mattress that you bought or the pair of jeans that you bought or whatever it was, the item that you used the Affirm credit for. And so it becomes much more obvious, like, what your cash flow is. And then the other thing, of course, is that you don't wind up in that credit card trap of running this huge random balance which accumulated on God knows what, and you're just like, you just have this debt.
On the other hand, as an article in Racked, I believe, pointed out this week.
This is Susie Cagle, which we will link to. Great article.
Noted that it seems that retailers who use Affirm suddenly see big spikes in their purchases.
Yeah.
So it's,
well, that's why. That's what Affirm is designed to do.
So there's a concern that while you really do know exactly what you're paying, it may also just be, you know, not subsidizing, but financing needless and possibly ill-considered consumption.
Yeah, because again, even if you are paying off a very expensive pair of jeans, they seem obsessed with this pair of jeans in this article.
Well, it is rag.
Yeah, they had to frame it. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So So even if you are paying this off in an installment plan, you are still paying a pretty high rate of interest on this purchase. And you could potentially still, if you're paying it by installments, it's probably because you couldn't just afford to make this purchase. So these still could get you into some financial trouble.
Certainly. And so this is the question which I have for Rachel, which is why I'm very happy that Rachel is here, which is you studied a lot of, families on constrained incomes. I have this like gut feeling. I hate sort of spend shaming people. I feel that people spend generally in pretty rational ways, and that like when middle class people turn around and say, "You spent how much on a pair of sneakers?" I'm like, ugh, just like fingernails down a blackboard for me. But is Jordan's worry in any way like based in reality, that like people just spend in stupid ways, and if they only didn't spend in stupid ways, then they'd have more money?
I'm with you on this. Like, I can't go there, because I think for the most part, people are really rational about what they spend. And to splurge on something is a human need and desire, right? So, and the idea that you would be perfectly disciplined about your spending all the time is like, you're going to be perfectly disciplined about what you eat all the time. Like, it's not fun.
I am typically not into spend shaming people either. I think the issue that people brought up with Affirm, and I should say it's like their average APR is like 19%, or it's not outrageous. You know, they're charging rates that are above a credit card, but well below a payday loan. But it seems to be that they are, right now at least, generally working with merchants who, you know, are selling optional stuff. Their goal is not to help you fix your busted car tire.
I actually think this is kind of important, because even in the article, they pointed out that they are really not targeting the people you were talking about. They are targeting what they called, which I actually think is, I don't like this term, the temporarily poor, by which they mean it's kind of like SoFi, that they're targeting people who have probably graduated from good colleges, are starting out in their careers. They may not have the greatest financial, like, you know, if you snapshot right now, but they have a lot of potential, and they're probably less of a risk than they might appear to be. So really, they are not targeting the financially precarious. Right. I would argue they are targeting like college grads of like from good schools.
So that is where they started, because they started in a very kind of, you know, millennial friendly techie way, but they moved away from that pretty quickly. And their biggest area of growth is actually bricks and mortar stores rather than online spending. Their big place where they started was mattresses. Mattresses are expensive. People often don't have enough money to buy a mattress, and yet you kind of need a mattress, and you don't want a secondhand mattress. So, like, you know, there's a lot of demand, and there's
you could just get a Casper mattress.
So they started with mattresses, and that worked out quite well. But then what they wound up doing pretty quickly, which is fascinating to me, is they moved onto the high street in relatively poor neighborhoods. And they said, and they went into a whole bunch of stores where any store basically selling stuff for over $100. In a poor neighborhood, if you're trying to sell something for over $100, people aren't going to have that kind of cash. And so they were like, yeah, just at the checkout counter, instead of not being able to buy it or having to put it on layaway, you can just do it on this Affirm system. And that worked out pretty well for them, with like genuinely like poor neighborhoods, not the sort of upwardly mobile college grad types. And the problem with that is that the interest rate is hidden. The interest rate that you pay Affirm is exactly what Jordan was saying. It's 19% or something relatively reasonable. But the merchant is also paying Affirm a whole bunch of extra money out of the sticker price. And the sticker price, if you go into a brick and mortar store on a high street in, you know, a poor neighborhood, is going to be higher than the sticker price on Amazon or Walmart or something like that. And so there's like a hidden extra interest rate that you wind up paying, which is built
poverty
tax, which is built into the price.
Right. Right.
Which that to me changes everything about this. I mean, I was prepared to be really excited about the structure of it. I mean, installment loans where you have a set payment over time and a clear understanding of exactly what you're going to pay are a dramatic improvement over payday loans and over credit cards in lots of ways. But if then there's this hidden fee, then that seems like a total bait and switch on that idea.
And again, it doesn't totally surprise me, though, because unfortunately, if you are lending to consumers that have potentially more volatile incomes, you are almost certainly going to have to charge a significantly higher interest rate.
And this is what the Affirm people told me, was that their default rates on these like brick and mortar stores in poor neighborhoods are, you know, significantly higher than that 19% interest rate would imply. But because of the extra deal that they do with the merchants, they get to you know, they get to finance it, and these people get their goods, and maybe it's worth it, and maybe it's not, and I'm conflicted on this one.
Well, I feel like with credit, the constant problem is better good enough, right? Because, and there's also conflation of two issues. So on the one hand, like this, even with what you just described, is a better product than a payday loan.
Definitely.
Right? That's not negotiable. So that's an improvement in the marketplace. And do we, you know, cheer for that and say, great? Or do we spend our time saying, well, but it's still not good enough? And that's continually the problem when you talk about credit innovation.
The other thing that seems a little problematic, at least with Affirm right now, is that its algorithm is constantly changing. And some consumers are talking about how, okay, I was able to get a loan from you guys once, but now I'm getting denied and, you know, it's a point of sale. It's not something you can really predict. So it seems like as a solution to income volatility, this is kind of volatile or could potentially be volatile. And so that kind of worries me a little bit too, if that becomes like a, you know, a credit card seems like at least, or I guess the question again is, you know, is the perfect the enemy of the good? A credit card, you kind of know if you can use it for the most part, whereas with this,
and often you wind up maxing it out and you can't, and you wind up in this debt spiral. And one of the interesting things about Affirm is that it's overwhelmingly used for goods rather than services.
Okay.
And so it's actually a thing which you own, which you are now paying off. You are still sleeping on that mattress. And when you pay your monthly thing to pay off your mattress, you're like, yeah, this is my mattress, I'm paying it off, as opposed to, you know, I went out for some drinks and it went onto my credit card and I haven't paid off my credit card and those drinks are somehow still on my credit card 3 years later and what the hell, you know?
Yeah, although the good you bought essentially, like, I mean, I guess you're using it, so it has value in that sense. It doesn't have any real like resale value, but although I will say, going back a little bit to what you were saying with their underwriting model, that's actually the part that I found interesting. That I do think we all know that the FICO model is so broken and we need a better model. And part of what they were even saying in terms of when they were kind of describing the way that this is structured, it is a very dynamic model and it does change constantly. It's using tons and tons of data points. And I actually think that could be a good thing moving forward.
But that also kind of adds to the black boxiness of it, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, that's true.
Why is black boxiness a bad thing?
I mean, have we not like spent like episode after episode on this show talking about why algorithms that we can't see through and don't really know what their standards are for judging whether we're credit worthy are worrisome?
I do agree, but I do think that the more kind of specific and tailored it is, like based on someone, potentially someone's own like activity, then arguably you could have less room for kind of more overt discrimination.
Well, it's definitely, and even not overt discrimination. I talked to them about this for Impact and they are, you know, they definitely talk very strongly about caring about it. And they were on the CFPB advisory board and like they consider that to be a comparative advantage for them, that they are actually more ahead of the game on, they reckon they're much better in terms of disparate impact than, say, FICO is.
I think it would be good if we knew some metrics about how people actually, how this actually impacts people's financial health, right? So that's really the barrier that credit underwriting hasn't gotten to yet. So credit underwriting is designed to tell the lender whether or not you're going to pay it back. It's not designed to tell whether or not this loan is a good choice in your life at all. Right? That's what starts to get to the consumption issue. So it might be that they have the best possible underwriting to figure out whether or not you're going to pay back your pants loan, right? But that doesn't actually give you, as the consumer, the information you need to decide, like, should I take out this loan in the first place? And presumably, if you're designing a wonderful, brilliant algorithm based on the best possible data ever, you could do that instead of like stopping at this objective of just, am I going to get paid back?
And it is actually possible that the people who got the first loan and didn't get the second loan ran into exactly that the Affirm, you know, omniscient algo machine was like, yeah, you one was good, two is too many.
It's possible, but
and that's an important move. You know, I think it makes sense. This is the problem that everyone always used to have with payday loans, is that, you know, one is fine, two or three or more is just disastrous, and it's good to kind of cut people off at some point.
But I think what Rachel is saying is that the people who get cut off should be told why they're being cut off, or at least told ahead of time if they're likely to get into trouble. Like, if rather than just saying you've been declined, it's say you've been declined because you've had some trouble paying off X, X, and X.
Yeah. And, you know, in the article, like, a firm makes some noises in the direction of, we would use this data to give people the advice and products they need outside of loans. That, like, that's fantastic if you get there. I don't know how close they are to that.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company, and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, who wants to talk about the way that municipalities around the world, or at least around the country, are just like
prostrating themselves before Jeff Bezos,
throwing away all remote attempts at democratic legitimacy and saying, no, you just get to be emperor of our town, Mr. Amazon.
Rahm Emanuel pretty much just like got a really nice hotel suite in the Drake and like covered the bed in rose petals for like, it's just like, it's really depressing.
But you see, that's the less objectionable part. So, okay a little bit of rewinding. There has been, I don't know how many thousand applications to Amazon saying, from various towns and cities around the country, saying, you should build your HQ here. And thanks to Freedom of Information requests, we've seen about 30 of them now. And so Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, his great idea was, well, okay, all of your employees are going to pay income tax, you know, Chicago income tax. And that's great for Chicago, except for what we will do is we will take all of those revenues and just give them to Amazon.
Yeah, it's called an edge bond or something. This is a thing in Illinois. I had never read about it before. The Chicago Reader has long written about these kinds of giveaways. The state really specializes in this kind of just foolishness. But you're right. That's not even the most embarrassing of the pitches that cities have made. It's Fresno, I think, that just said, you can tell us how to spend your tax money. Like, whatever money that Amazon pays or tax revenue it generates, you can direct us to, like, whatever. You can have us build a park, and we'll put a sign that says, park brought to you by Jeff Bezos' shiny bald face. Like, it's just, I can't.
But it's actually even worse than that a lot of these offers are basically not an offer of, we have a city and we would like you to build your headquarters in our city, and much more, we will let you build your own city, and we will throw money at you and various other incentives to build your city, but you will be in charge of your city, and you get to make the rules.
Yes.
And it's deeply undemocratic in that it's not even the employee / residents of the city which get to determine their own fate. It's their employer. And I feel like we haven't had one of those sort of company towns in like almost 100 years now. Like, that used to be a thing, that kind of
you would
paternalist
literally.
Company town where the company would build all the housing and be in charge of everything and house its employees.
Railroad barons really were fond of it. Like, that was, a big deal.
You got paid in company scrip.
There was a great one in just outside Liverpool in England called Port Sunlight, which was built by Lever Brothers before it became Unilever. And they were ahead of their time. They were actually like good places to live, and people had like relatively good lives. But like, I feel like we've moved on from that, or should have.
And yet,
although to play devil's advocate a little bit, just again, I'm not saying that this isn't like disturbing. I think it is, although I think it's more part of a larger question about kind of the state of companies right now and just the discrepancy between when you work for certain companies, what people's lives are like versus when you work for almost any other company, and why this is why people want Amazon to come so much, because it's not just that Amazon will come with their employees and their investment. It's that will almost certainly, if we've seen what's happened in Seattle, bring many other companies that will come into the town as well and really, you know, expand the tax base, increase the talent pool. There are a lot of very real benefits that people are looking for. And I would also argue that, again, I don't think a lot of these what these cities are trying to do is a good thing. I don't think it is. But I think to say that this is like this enormous threat to democracy may be a little overstated.
I want to ask you to put those two thoughts together a little bit more clearly. On the one hand, yes, we understand that there are sort of residual benefits to having Amazon in your town. On the other hand, we also understand that having corporations have an outsized say in how a town is run as opposed to individuals is inherently anti-democratic. What is the connection between the two? Why do you think that the residual benefits of having a corporation in your town in any way kind of mitigate the anti-democratic effects of what's on the table here?
Because even if you are right now saying, okay, Amazon, we're going to allow you to direct a certain portion of the tax dollars that you're generating. Again, at the same time, the city is still being run with the same democratic processes that it was before.
No, that's actually not true. That's the bit which is
worrying. I know what you're saying, but again, what I'm arguing is that
I guess what you're saying is that the city that existed before Amazon showed up is at least being run, whereas like Amazon, if you think of Amazon as an adjunct to the city, I think this is what you're saying, at least. If you think of Amazon as like a new city, just kind of like tacked on to Fresno, then the rest of Fresno is still being run just like before. There's no real change, except for there's this, you know, additional company town that's sort of on the edge of things. My question is how separate are those two things really going to
be? Yeah, I feel like Amazon, basically what is being done here is that a bunch of cities have effectively gone up to Amazon and saying, we will not only give you money and space and tax incentives, but we will actually give you the keys to City Hall to a large degree as well.
Yes, but I also don't know some of the like very like explicit details of how these deals are structured in terms of, frankly, the length and the idea of, you know, if Amazon were to come, how much control they would actually potentially have long term. I honestly don't think those deals have all been fully fleshed out. But again, I do think the idea is that we, sorry, I'm trying to think of.
I
still think if you have citizens of Fresno who disagree with what is happening and they push back against the current government, I have a hard time to imagine that that isn't going to have implications for Amazon, and that they are literally creating just this new city that will have no restrictions on them based on other state and city regulations. I find that hard to believe.
I don't find it that hard to believe, because a lot of these deals, once they get made, are, you know, they're enforceable by contract. Like, you can't really go back on them. Like, you can vote out the mayor, but you can't vote out Amazon once it's there and it has its deal.
I also think the way you're describing it is this, you know, a separate city aside from Fresno is really like allows us to then connect this to our thinking about what's happened in cities that increasingly change their lines of incorporation for other reasons. Right. So in Detroit, for example, where like gradually all the money has moved to the suburbs and so has the political power. And then what is the inner city left with? Right. So in that model of like, well, won't the citizens just push back on this Amazon? Like, I think that's hard for me to see, like in the context of what happens elsewhere.
And I don't just agree with that. I mean, I think there's I do agree with that. I mean, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I do think, again, if you have Amazon come in and Amazon then attracts a lot of other companies that are also coming in, I don't think you're necessarily just going to have Amazonville and then everything else.
No, we're not talking about this. It is a possibility. It is a scary possibility. It is also like invidious in the way that Amazon has set it up in this kind of Hunger Games-y kind of way.
Yeah.
Of like, we are just going, like, there's going to be a winner's curse, right? Yeah. If you have 3,000 municipalities all trying to outdo each other, then whoever wins that race is going to lose.
I don't entirely agree with that, but and it's because I think the towns that are making these offers, like the really shocking ones like Fresno, are probably going to lose this race.
Yes.
The reason they are making these offers is because they don't have enough to offer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little surprising for me to see Chicago, because that's a city that a lot of people thought just on its kind of merits might be able to attract Amazon. But you know, again,
you've
they're
seen
not
the finances yeah, in Illinois.
That's true. But and again, they're not handing over City Hall so much as they are just handing over the people's money. But what does worry me about this is it's sort of a huge demonstration to the rest of corporate America of just how much you can ask for. Like, it's
don't even need to ask. They will just give it to you.
And you might not be Amazon, but if you can, you know, show up and, you know, do your own RFP for, like, you know, this, it seems like, I don't think this is going to be the last time a major company tries to pull this. I think Jeff Bezos might be setting a template here. And so that's why this really kind of frightens me. It's, you know, okay, maybe Fresno's not going to hand over City Hall this time, but it might to another company.
Can I just come in with like one little bit of good news? Like, what is the biggest, most powerful company in America? Probably right now it's Apple, certainly in terms of market cap.
Yeah.
And they are not only in a big fight with Cupertino right now. They are losing fight with Cupertino.
Is it over parking? What is it over? what are they fighting over at the moment?
Well, yeah, the problem with, they have this shiny, gleaming new campus in Cupertino, and the problem is that there's nowhere for their employees to live because it's a very low-density neighborhood, and they just need to house their employees. And so they are proposing to build housing, basically, so their employees can live somewhere in the neighborhood. And Cupertino, in classic Silicon Valley NIMBY-ish fashion, is saying, no, you can't do any building. We can't have any. And Cupertino is winning that fight.
But that's like, okay, rich white people can like slay other rich white people. Like that.
Yes.
That's like what we're learning from that. That's not a desperate city trying to attract a new company. It's a little bit different here. Cupertino is already rich. They don't need to worry about Apple. Plus, Apple just set down roots. It cannot pull up. Like, there is no, they are there. They have settled.
I do think that goes a little bit to support what I was saying and the idea that I don't think that if you have a company come in and generate a lot of revenue, a lot of potentially like ancillary jobs, that the people there will just inherently lose all political power. Because I think part of the problem of what you happened in Detroit was also that just everything, all that, like the corporations, everything moved outside of the city. And I don't see that as exactly what we're potentially to see happening here.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Let's have a numbers round.
Okay, my number's silly, so I should just get it out of the way. It's an obvious one, but it's 10,000. Bitcoin broke 10,000.
Not that one.
Yeah, so, oh. Okay, so wait, here's my question. Like, this is just Jordan asking dumb question. Like, as Bitcoin gets like this ludicrously expensive, does it become worse as a medium of exchange? Like, shouldn't it? Yeah, it does. It is becoming a...
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that in pretty much entirely orthogonal.
Okay.
Like, I transacted for Bitcoin when it was $5, and I transacted for Bitcoin when it was $3,000. I haven't transacted for Bitcoin since it's been $10,000, but I could... quite easily, and it would be just as easy. Like, the amount of Bitcoin you're spending obviously goes down,
yeah,
you know, for any given dollar amount, but other than that, it's basically the same.
So this is kind of a blow to like the econ nerds who are doubting Bitcoin back in the day, because we all assumed, okay, it's got this big deflationary bias, and that if it ever spikes in price, people are going to sit on it and they're not going to want to trade any or sell any. Because...
Oh, that's definitely true.
Okay, that...
if it's, well, it's not so much the price, it's the price rise. That yeah. if the price is rising, then people don't want to spend their Bitcoin because they would rather see the capital gains from just sitting on it.
But you're saying it's not that hard to transact in it, and it seems like there's enough liquidity right now. It seems like volume's actually getting higher as it gets. So
now, volume in Bitcoin terms is falling a little bit, but in dollar terms, it's rising.
Okay, so maybe... Okay, I need to research this further to figure out if we've all been proven wrong or not. Stay tuned.
It's very random what happened in Bitcoin, but just to explain for listeners who... haven't been following this the crazy, and by the way, congratulations if you haven't, because there's no reason why you should. It kind of spiked from sort of 7,000-8,000 ish all the way up to about 11,000, and then dropped back down to 9,000. It lost 20% in one day, that kind of thing. It's highly volatile right now. Bitcoin every 18 months or so goes through one of these periods of extreme volatility, and then generally it kind of settles somewhere. And my base case is that the future will resemble the past, and it will find some new higher level where it will settle and be relatively less volatile for a while. But right now it's super volatile. Anna?
Mine is 252,000 per second. That would be the number of transactions that went through the Alibaba servers.
Woof. That's probably about, I'm going to guess, two orders of magnitude higher than transactions per second in Bitcoin.
Yeah, so this was on Singles Day, which is 11/11. And this, it just... so much bigger than anything we would see on like a Black Friday or Cyber Monday. Because in total, it was 25 billion in one day on Singles Day.
On one website.
I think that 25 billion may be from Alibaba and JD.com. I don't know if that's just, but the 252,000 per second is just through Alibaba's servers.
Still, that's giant.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
My number is 100 million. Which is the number of dollars that Chase has invested in Chase Pay, which is a technology which, as far as I can make out, about 8 people have ever used.
I've used it.
Someone paid me in it once. I was really angry because I had to like register my email for them to send me the money. Anyway.
My family will not use Venmo. I hate checks. I have Chase.
There are a gazillion competing payment protocols out there. Venmo is a kind of, it's basically PayPal with emojis. but there's many others. There's Square Cash. There's Apple Cash is coming out any minute now. There's Chase Pay. There's Square and Stripe and, you know, a gazillion others. And I'm not quite sure why everyone is trying to build all of these clever digital payment app layers on top of like the old antiquated creaky ACH and credit card pipes. But apparently this is the kind of thing that Chase will spend $100 million on, and it baffles me why.
I'd rather them invest it than, you know, give that money to it as a dividend to their shareholders. So whatever.
Okay. Right,
so that was some employees getting that
exactly.
As so, wages. So good enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Rachel, you got to finish off.
I get the last one.
You get the last one.
So true to the topic, I'm expert in. I'll say my number is $400. Half of Americans cannot easily come up with $400 without borrowing. or selling something, which is a pretty scary number when you think about it.
And so I've seen this number bandied around a lot in various different contexts. Does that mean that they don't have, as I understand it, that means they don't have $400 of credit on a credit card? That wouldn't count as borrowing. That they just don't have it in an emergency any easy way.
They have, it means they don't have it like on cash on hand or saved. About another big chunk, another 30%, say they can get that money if they borrow it. Right. So it's a much smaller percentage of Americans who just cannot get it at all. 14% or something like that.
OK.
So that's the way to think about it. But like the idea that you wouldn't have $400 to your name if something came up is striking.
Yeah, I just got a speeding ticket for almost that much.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Which is why. Yeah. Yeah. All sorts of expenses would immediately cause you to need that amount of money.
OK. I think that is it. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you so much for coming in to Slate Money. It's been absolutely amazing to have you here. Your book is The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. It is out now from Princeton University Press, those lovely people. And thank you as well to Dan Schrader for all of his work on this. And most importantly, to everyone here listening, we still have space left on our voicemail machine. The number is,
oh my god,
347-960-6314. That's in the show notes. Call us up, leave us a question, and we will answer it in a special holiday Q&A call-in edition of Slate Money in later this month. So listen to El Gabfest, an Espanol from Leon Krauser. He's one of my Univision colleagues, and he has his own Gabfest in Spanish. And that will not only get you up to speed on the news of the day, but will also help you with your Spanish. So listen to that. It comes out every Thursday. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.